Hello and welcome everybody to the No Normal Show for Thursday, October 1st, 2020, brought to you by Revive Health. This is our weekly deep dive into how hospital and health system marketers can navigate what we're calling the No Normal. I'm Chris Bevelo, Health Systems Practice Lead at Revive Health, and your host for the show. I'm joined by Chase Kleckner, who is Senior Marketing Manager at Revive Health and our show's producer. Hello, Chase.
Hey, Chris. Good to see you as always.
And we are also joined by Brian Hamilton. Brian, we see that you're there, but we don't see your video.
Oh, that's a problem. Can you hear me?
You're not in witness protection program, so you're okay. Yeah, we can hear you. Let me introduce you while you figure out your camera. There you are. Brian, there he is the Assistant Vice President of Marketing and Communications at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. He leads the strategic thinking, integrated planning, communications, and creative execution across service lines, creative services, and digital to enable the delivery of Cincinnati Children's strategic plan and growth opportunities. Prior to Cincinnati Children's, Brian had an 18-year career as Global Brand Director at Procter & Gamble. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Chris. Good to see you.
It is good to see you as well, literally and figuratively. Looking forward to diving in with you, sir. Some notes before we do that. On this podcast, if you're new to the show, we will be sharing industry trends, research, stories from those with an outside perspective, or those who are on the inside, like Brian. Actually, Brian has both, which is why he's going to be a great guest, and other ideas and content to help health system marketers navigate what we call the no normal. If you want to understand what we mean by that, if you want to know what our key principles of the no normal are, check out the blog post that we wrote a while back when we launched this podcast. Those principles still hold true, and they will hold true as long as we are in the no normal. Chase will be sharing a link to that in the chat function. Speaking of the chat function and the Q&A function, we would love to get questions from those of you that are able to join us live. If you would like Brian or myself or Chase to answer a question, just make sure it goes in the Q&A queue in Zoom. You can use the chat function that's also part of Zoom to talk with other attendees. Again, Chase may be posting things there as we go through the show. But if you'd like us to answer a question, we monitor that Q&A queue. So make sure it goes in there. We may answer them as we go along. And always there's time at the end as well. Also remember that if you're new to the show or you didn't know this before, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, we post a recording of the video version of this show on our website by the end of today. You can find that at thinkrevivehealth.com/COVID-19. Okay, those be the notes. You ready to dive in, sir?
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
All right. Well, let's just start with, I mentioned that this show, you know, we try to bring in folks who are, you know, in the thick of the health system marketing world, but also sometimes we bring in people from outside our space because we can learn so much from that. And you, I think, bring both of those perspectives. So we mentioned that you spent a long time at Procter & Gamble. Most people know and recognize Procter & Gamble as, if not the premier, one of the premier marketing organizations in the world. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about your time at Procter & Gamble, what was meant by brand management, you know, what did that look like, what your role was, and then how that kind of contrasts with the world that you're in now and in the health system space.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. So first of all, I would say that P&G is the predominant, you know, marketer in the world. And honestly, I say that because brand management was birthed at P&G, quite literally. And the idea behind brand management at P&G and probably most CPG companies is that the brand is really the center of the business and center of the wheel. And so the brand manager in that context really has the lead seat at the table. And that's really surrounded by a cross-functional or multifunctional team. And interestingly, that starts from day one. So as you walk into the doors as a assistant brand manager and eventually a brand manager, you're really tasked with owning the P&L. And why is the marketer or the brand manager at the center? Is because there's a couple mantras, at least when I first started at P&G, and that is consumer is boss. And whoever understands the consumer really has kind of the power. And so you know, quite frankly, as a 23-year-old, 24-year-old starting at P&G, walking into my first conference room, you, first of all, had a captive audience from your multifunctional, cross-functional partners, but they were really looking to you to help drive the overall brand strategy, starting with what are the needs of the consumer. And so when you understand the consumer, you understand their desired consumer experiences, whether they're articulated or unarticulated, they really were looking at you. And so, you know, I often tell the story as a 24-year-old, I'd walk in and there could be an R&D scientist, right, who or a product supply specialist or a salesperson who had 24 years experience at P&G, except they would still often look to the brand manager for their direction moving forward. So pretty different dynamic as you think about brand management and owning that versus maybe my current state. There are a couple of other things I think that are important about brand management at P&G, and that is you're really responsible for moments of truth. And that is starting with the what we call the zero moment of truth. And that was for a consumer when they were thinking about making a purchase. And now we would say that's online reviews, for example. And so they were doing their research before they bought whatever that packaged good might be. So you're really responsible for winning at that zero moment of truth. When they had that selection in their mind, then you had to win at the first moment of truth, which is when they entered to the shelf. I guess now it would be a virtual shelf. So as they're shopping virtually online or if they're in the store, you needed to win there too. There was another opportunity for you to win or lose, right? It was binary. And the third part of the equation is the second moment of truth. And that's when, what is the experience that that consumer has with your product once they've made the selection? Because that will drive the repeat. And I think that framework actually is quite relevant to my job today too. But the difference being that we really need to make sure that everybody understands there is a zero moment of truth. And it's not just about that first moment of truth, meaning when they're in the examining room or when they're undergoing whatever procedure. And there is a second moment of truth too, which is what is that outcome and what is that experience post-operative, right? So how does billing and everything else go? And understanding that journey and recognizing that each of those is a discriminant piece of information that the consumer, I'm using the C word, is going to make a choice on, and really winning there is really what's important.
So we were joking a little bit there as we went along, but obviously the way you described a brand manager at the center of the universe and the Procter and Gamble situation, not exactly the way the marketing leader sits in the health system. And there's valid reasons for that. But talk a little bit about, you know, what most people understand, why, you know, that's not the case. What did that feel like for you as you moved into an organization? You know, what are the challenges posed by that, but also some of the opportunities that you see given the difference in the role marketing plays?
Yeah, I think the biggest difference is that whereas at P&G, your fortune, as I said, to walk into a room and there's an understanding of the value of brand, there's already a built-in value of marketing. But that didn't happen, I'm sure, day one, right? There was a long history of that and building confidence in that. I think the difference is within healthcare marketing is you're at zero, right, when you walk in. And you need to build that and build that trust. I think that's true anywhere, really, is building that trust. But whereas, to your point, and I'll just go along with our fun story here, whereas you are, you know, the brand manager or the marketeer is center of the wheel, that is certainly not the position. It shouldn't be the position, to be honest with you, within healthcare. But I do think there is still a great value that a marketer or brand manager brings to the table. And I think that's where we have to go back to some of those tenets that I talked about. Patient is boss, right? Consumer, right? Patient, consumer, and how do we think about them in that journey? So for example, the value of having a online presence, the value of reputation, those impact that zero moment of truth, right? When a patient family is making a decision on whether or not they're going to have care at Cincinnati Children's or another option, that's real. And I think there's an opportunity to educate our faculty, our providers. So I'm at an academic medical center. So educating them on that value of what can be found out about them in terms of ratings and reviews, the value of making sure that their differentiated service or procedure is widely known. And it's not just amongst a small subset of people. The power of family groups, right? And the forums and chat forums that are taking place. Those are all real things. And to acknowledge those is to acknowledge that there is some consumerism in the selection process, right? And that, I think, is going back to the zero moment of truth, right? From a first moment of truth, now that is, you know, certainly where I say, that's not my expertise. And that's often, I think, where marketers struggle a little bit is the physician will always understand the patient better than I do. But getting the patient to them is, I think, really where we can bring value. I think we've certainly made a lot of headway at Cincinnati Children's. And it starts with building trust, right? It starts with sitting down, understanding what are we trying to accomplish, and bringing value through insights into that patient family before they came to Cincinnati Children's. What was their journey? What was the selection kind of process they went through? And how did we provide them information in a very targeted way to get them to care to the right provider at the right time?
So you talk about this zero moment of truth, which I think is a really cool way to kind of phrase that. And of course, the challenge in our world often is people approach that zero moment of truth with the assumption that somebody needs what it is we have to offer. And in healthcare, we have this famous saying that says, Joe Public doesn't care about your hospital, right? So oftentimes in that zero moment of truth, you have to approach them with something that's more relevant than the service you're offering, because they may not need that service in the moment, but you can still connect with them. You have told a story, Brian, of your time at Procter & Gamble, and excuse me for forgetting the name of the campaign, but it was for a feminine product that you were working with, and it was a campaign focused on girls. And I'm sure you know which one I'm talking about, but I would love to you to kind of explain it, because I think that's a great example of a campaign that's focused at a zero moment, even before somebody's necessarily looking to buy a product or shop for, in our case, clinical care, of engaging them at a zero moment. So you know what I'm talking about, right?
Can you explain? I do. You're talking about Like a Girl.
Yeah.
Like a Girl was the global always campaign that I had good fortune to work on. And I think why that's a great example is the category of feminine care is often thought to be, you know, not one that you can really break through in major ways through new technology, although we did have new technology, right? But, you know, or breakthrough ways to deliver the product. And what we really focused on is the consumer insight of confidence and how a girl's confidence actually drops when she actually, about the time she has her first period at puberty. Interestingly, male's confidence continues to rise throughout their life. So we commissioned this study that really demonstrated that. And what we really started to understand is the social impacts of confidence in girls dropping over time. So that actually got us to what are the things that are happening in society that cause a deterioration in confidence. Now, again, we weren't talking product at all, to your point here, Chris. We are talking about true emotions and true insights into the psychology of females. And so Like a Girl was really taking on some of those norms, which is why is Like a Girl in society often positioned as a negative thing? It should be a positive statement. And so really flipping that on its head. Ultimately, what that did was, interestingly, is always, so pads were declining with millennials and actually younger girls outside of their first period. generally tampon was the preferred menstrual product. And we saw actually always as a brand become one of the love marks of millennial girls because of the campaign and the idea that we are raising their confidence, recognizing some of the things that are happening in society, and created that connection when otherwise we would not have had that connection. And so, you know, a great example of not necessarily Zero Moment of Truth, but being in the selection set, being a part of the discussion when otherwise we would never have an opportunity to be part of that discussion.
Yeah, that's a great, it's a great example. I'm glad you shared it. And you mentioned the study that you did, and there's a, I happened to actually look at the chat and there was a comment in there about one of the biggest learnings or challenges coming from somewhere other than healthcare into this space is the lack of data, the lack of quantitative input to guide decision-making, to guide understanding of audiences. You mentioned kind of the things you just did for Like a Girl. And I know you have spoken about that struggle in moving into this space. Do you want to talk a little bit about maybe the differences in how, you know, those quantitative research has is treated within and without, and what you're trying to do at Cincinnati Children's to move that forward?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. It's a great question. I assume from a fellow CPG-er who probably had more data than they knew what to do with in their old life, which is true, honestly, that at P&G we had, you know, just more volumes of data that actually the fear was paralysis through analysis versus just, you know, having the data itself. So agreed, this is a huge struggle, but I actually think it's in part our responsibility. So I think another big change, and I'll get to the specific of the question on data, but I think another big change for me, back to your original question on going from CPG to healthcare marketing, is largely healthcare marketing, I think, has been reactive communication, right? It's really hard to have quantitative data on reactive communication, right? Whereas if you start to shift it to be more proactive marketing, you can set up data collection, right? And so that is something we've been trying to do at Children's, is when we establish campaigns or any type of communication tactic, that we are making sure that we can measure whatever that impact is. Not easy. For lots of reasons that I don't have to go into. But putting that out there as it is a requirement that whatever we are doing is measurable, is a first start. The other thing that's interesting to think about my present situation is, in terms of the data, is that we do have lots of data because we have the patient data. It's how do you use it in a way that is respectful, is appropriate, is the challenge, I think, in itself. And that's a new layer of challenge that I you know, did not have at P&G, nor did probably my other CPG marketer who's on the line as well. So figuring that out and actually intentionally mapping that through is something we've done you know, over the last, call it 2 to 3 years, including all of our campaigns that are driving to inquiries. We are understanding how are we doing that along the way and measuring that ultimately in the end, you could look at the value of that initial inquiry.
Right. So we're talking about data as something that's important to putting the consumer at the center. You mentioned that was like the core philosophy in your Procter & Gamble days. Another thing, you know, shifting gears, but related is structure of the marketing team. And Brian, you were part of a session we had about two weeks ago tomorrow, where we had 30 marketing leaders from health systems from around the country come together and talk about marketing structure. We're actually going to have a report out of some of the learnings and discussions from that session that we'll share with everybody. I think it'll be ready next week. But there was a lot of interesting conversations surrounding structure. So let's just start with, from your perspective, when you think about trying to put the consumer at the center and keeping true to that philosophy, how does that impact how you think about the structure of your team?
Yeah, no, so it's interesting. Just to go back to P&G, you know, why they really structured around brands is that everybody, no matter if you're in sales, product supply, finance, HR, we all shared one common thing, which was that brand, right? And the consumer of that brand. And so you really organized around the brand in that way. And recently I've had conversations with other you know, chief marketing officers within healthcare about the brand management model. And it really comes to some of the tenets I've talked about. Responsibility, so owning the P&L, having decision authority within, whether it's within an institute or department. Those are big changes within the healthcare system and structure. So I think most marketing communication departments in healthcare are probably more designed around function. So internal communications, external relations, digital, CRM, et cetera. I think there's the biggest opportunity, Chris, is to start to shift that to if we put the patient in the center of that, right? Or if you put a program in the center of that and you start to build a structure even within marketing communications around something more discrete, I think it starts to shift things, right? It starts to shift our thinking and how we operate from a siloed viewpoint to an integrated collaborative viewpoint, right? I think it starts to make digital, people feel digital is owned by everyone, right? So if you own the digital experience and it's digital first in everything you do, that also shifts the way that you structure, right? So rather than being, you know, the jack of one trade, you are actually are surrounding a different goal and a different end deliverable. And I think that changes how we all operate. I think it identifies capabilities we probably have not had in our teams before that we probably need to go get. I know some of my peers, and this was discussed in the event you're talking about, are really going out and going after people who have been in CPG or in direct-to-consumer companies because there's capabilities about how do you target a population and use the most efficient methods to get to and speak with that population where they want to be met, right? Versus casting your favorite example, I'm sure, Chris, a big billboard, right? A billboard is the most blunt tool that you can have, right? Whereas there are a lot more laser-like surgical tools in our marketing toolbox that can get to a consumer faster, more efficiently, and meet them where they are, not where we hope they might be.
So I want to ask you, especially since you're coming from a world where, as you described it, you know, Procter & Gamble, you've got a product. So maybe it's Always pads, or maybe it's whatever, you know, Tide.
Pringles.
Whatever, Pringles. There you go. Yeah. Pringles. We'll take Pringles, right? Even Pringles has a variety of things, right? But I think one of the challenges that we all feel, but it's often just unspoken, is Clayton Christensen said, a hospital is the only factory that has 100 products. And what he meant by that is, it's no wonder these organizations are inefficient if you want to measure them by other, you know, outside industry metrics, because they are a factory, which is a crude word, but they are a building, an organization that is set up to deal with 100 different things, cancer patient, heart patient, diabetic patient, emergency, primary care, like all of these are different. And if you think about them as we have different service lines, right? So if you want to break it down to your service lines, most health systems have a couple dozen service lines, and maybe they prioritize 4 or 6 or 10 or whatever. That has to, you know, coming from a world, Brian, where you're the brand manager of Pringles and you're selling Pringles, and you got your finance woman here, and you've got your supply chain guy, and you got your saleswoman, and they're all on Pringles.
Yeah.
And now here you are stepping into something that's like, hey, Brian, you're in charge of Pringles, Tide, Always pads, you name it.
Yeah.
You just have this one department. Go. What?
Yeah.
As dramatic as it should be, it seems like that would just be like a cold splash in the face.
And I'm still drying off. It is a different, it's a very different model and a very different approach, no doubt. I think the and as an academic medical center, also how important research is and the education part of it, right? And so an approach that we are taking is to really think about how do you build the reputation of the entire institution, and this idea of, you know, quite literally, you know, rising tides float all boats. So what are our truths that run across, whether you are a clinician, whether you're a researcher, whether you're a shared service, and what are those truths that run across all of it, and start there. It's almost about thinking about it as you have this umbrella concept, if you will. And then within each of those, I'll maybe use it as a more of a tent. So within that tent cover, you have very specific tent poles. Those tent poles, I would say, are the hundreds of different offerings that you have. But how do they ladder up to this larger spirit or larger reputation messaging that we're trying to build? This is something that we are very much in the start infancy of at Cincinnati Children's, but I think it is a real problem. It's not a problem. It's a real opportunity to try to solve for, and I think that does put our role as marketing communications very central into the strategy. So if we can line that up with the larger strategic aspirations for the institution, I think that there certainly is a place for our role and a structure that supports that moving forward. So it is a challenge. It's something, I'll just go back to P&G. You know, you mentioned brands that stand alone on their own, Tide, Pringles, Always, Crest, Pampers. Here in the United States, you don't hear P&G say, you know, P&G, you know, oh, we make Tide, we make et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I will remind you of a campaign that P&G had in the United States called Thank You Mom. And that was with the Olympics. I'm going to date myself here, but more than 10 years ago. And it really was, how do you bring this collection of brands together from P&G? And the central thing in that, their reputation, if you will, what I'm referring to is mom, right? We all have had a mom, and the sacrifices they went through, the pride that they have in seeing their kids, and brands are a part of that whole entire journey. And so inserting those brands into that journey laddered up to a larger campaign, a reputation, if you will, campaign for P&G.
So while we're on the topic of structure, we do have a question. So let's just go with it. And you can answer to whatever degree you're comfortable with, because every time we bring up structure, we'll get a question like this, and it's completely understandable. I think, like, we at Revive are dreaming of a way that we could have a Zoom meeting with 300 health systems where everybody just puts up their org chart. And that's all you see. It's like 300 org charts, and you can like zoom in on whichever one you want. You'd be like, oh, why are they doing that way? And I want to ask about that. And, oh, look at how many analysts they have over here. And because it is such a concrete thing. So that is the question. Can you explain, or can you describe how your team is structured? So you don't have to get into maybe specific roles or whatever, but just what is the breakdown of that structure?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, candidly, I'd say we're still very much in a functional structure. That's how I would define it, right? Versus a audience structure, or what I think, where I think the future is a system structure. And what I mean by system structure is focused on specific, as I was saying, big initiatives, big programs, et cetera, and really surrounding it more in that way. But to answer the question, fully transparently, we are, I would say, today in a functional structure. So what does that mean within marketing communications? As I said, we have internal communications, external communications, creative service team, service line marketing, insights group, and then our digital strategy team. And so there's leaders of each of those team, and there are on the lead team. And we really spend our time as a lead team trying to identify the opportunities for collaboration and integration across that, right? So being kind of, that's what's running across. But their teams are still very much in a functional kind of structure.
So let me ask you, one of the things that we'll often you know, it's kind of interesting going back for the last 10 years, the growth of the kind of the digital function, which is more than 10 years ago, but it's taken a long time. And then really after that came content as a potential function, and then kind of data and analytics. You didn't mention content. Is that something that's just divided up and managed among the
groups? I think content runs across, right? I think content, great content strategy needs to be, you know, kind of one of those items that runs across, an enabler, if you will. So I think, you know, personally, I think content is an enabler. Personally, I think digital is an enabler. So those are running kind of underneath those, if you will, columns of functions. In my opinion, I think those are the drivers that kind of hold it all together.
Okay. Another question came in. I think this is a simple question, but it could be a difficult answer. So I'll let you see. Can you give an example of how you would put patients at the center, given that's such a core philosophy?
Yeah, it's a simple but also very complex answer, right? Okay. So for example, we had when I came here to Children's 3 years ago, one of the programs that we were really trying to build and grow and invest behind was an adolescent and young adult cancer program. So as a pediatric hospital, that actually is a new patient population, right? Because we actually, I say adolescent, young adult, that is going into, you know, mid-20s, right? Specifically the needs and the programs and the differentiating things we could offer were very different. So we actually created a team around that effort, right? Which was had planning, strategy, marketing, communications, institutional, meaning within CBDI, Cancer Blood Disease Institute team. And we actually had our agency come and approach them as a completely different unit, right? But we are all very focused specifically on that population, about their barriers, concerns, and made sure that we had all the program elements to address their needs. Fertility, financial, meaning their financial and back to work programs, the social psychology part of it. So that created a program that made sure that we had all those elements. We also surrounded though that from a shared service standpoint too. So that was centralized around a patient population.
That's great. Put patient centricity and putting patients at the heart is unfortunately, it's gotten to be a bit of a cliche, because everybody, I think, over the last 5 to 10 years has kind of recognized, hey, this is what we should be doing. But it is a great question, because it's how you do it that matters and to what degree you do it. I remember working with a hospital years ago that just, we were working with their women and children. So, you know, close to your area at Cincy Children's. And they were very adamant that they were a patient-centric operation, that they put the patient first. And, you know, that's great. And then we got more into working with them. And one of the things they had done is they had, I don't know if you remember this, Brian, this might have been before your health system time, but they had closed the nursery in their hospital, because there had been, there was kind of a movement that, hey, the best thing for a newborn while the mom's in the hospital is be with the mom, not be in a nursery. So they had literally shuttered their nursery, right? But what happened was reality and patience, because a lot of moms were like, look, I gotta get some sleep here. Can you get this, my beloved child, out of the room, because I can't sleep. So what they ended up doing was having, and this is true, baby, you know, the babies were in carts. Carts were stacked up at the end of the hall because they couldn't go into a nursery, because moms wanted them out of their deal. And the idea that they closed the nursery but also at the same time were being patient centric, like, wait a second, if your patients are saying this, putting them at the heart, you probably wouldn't have taken that step. So it's just, it all comes down to what you're actually doing, I think, is the key to that. So I like that question, even though it seems like an obvious question. It's not an obvious answer.
No, can I build on it though, Chris?
Yeah,
too?
Please.
you know, what we found is that actually we didn't even have photography that looked like the patients we were trying to speak to. I mean, these are basic things, right? And so, like, well, we can't pull from our existing patient population in photography because we don't have that, right? So we had to go out and build that, right? We found that even the our brand guidelines have us speaking, because our patient, we're usually speaking to patient families of younger, right? Not to the patient. So it actually even caused us to change our voice. And I mean, these are things that, you know, we did not have in our brand guidelines, which is, what is our adult voice? Our voice was always speaking to patient families, to family for their patient. Now we needed to make sure we were changing our voice to speak to the patient. I know that seems small. It's not nuanced, though. That is the difference between, you know, back to Clayton Christensen, you know, it's binary. You either, you know, either you're getting bought or not, right? So it's you're hired or fired is his exact language. So that is the difference between being hired or fired, right? Is you're not going to hire somebody who's speaking to you like you are, you know, the guardian. No, speak to me that I am your patient. And so that was a big shift for a pediatric hospital.
Okay, we've got a couple more questions. So let's get those out of the way. Another area, a functional area that has grown up, but is interesting to me because there is no best practice for where this sits, and that's social media. So we have a lot of health systems that have social media as part of digital, the digital team. Some of them have it completely separate, some of the larger ones. Or it might be part of the comms team. And sometimes it's somewhere else, but it's usually one of those three. How do you handle social media in terms of your structure?
So presently, social media at Cincinnati Children's is in external relations, media relations. And largely that's because that's kind of what it was born out of, right? And so I think that, but I don't think that's unusual, meaning that things happen that way. Continue the theme of P&G to healthcare. As a assistant brand manager on the Folgers brand, this will date me, Chris, I guess, but the homepage of Folgers.com was not actually owned, if you will, by the marketing or brand team. It was actually owned in IS by an analyst. A brand page, like, you know, now, I mean, can you imagine, you know, a brand page being actually owned by an analyst, somebody who knows how to code, right? That was at P&G, as we established, you know, the powerhouse of marketing. And that wasn't that long ago, right? That was 15 years ago. And so I think, you know, now it's, you know, Dollar Shave Club, right? That is their store, right? Right. I mean, you know, what a change in these are technology years, but in 15 years to go from kind of an afterthought, if you will, from a marketing standpoint to it being, you know, the storefront for Amazon. I could pick the biggest one, right? So quite a shift, right? So to social media, I think we're in the same place, right? Which is where it logically fit and where it will be in the future, I think are probably two different places because social media is bigger than just external relations and media communications. It really is the start of that zero moment of truth in a lot of cases, right? And so I think that will continue to grow. And I think we need to nurture it and foster in a way that it continue to grow and be more more of one of those enablers, like I talked about, something that runs through kind of every part of it.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, last question. Can you speak a little bit about how you measure ROI on marketing campaigns and do you have patient acquisition revenue goals?
Honestly, we don't think about it as patient revenue, acquisition revenue goals, to be honest with you. How we measure ROI is really, if it is a campaign that's really trying to drive, as I mentioned, I think in my earlier example about driving inquiries or driving to the call to action is to request an appointment. Those to me have been the easiest and cleanest way to drive ROI because I can really follow through on whatever the medium or campaign tactic is that is trying to drive a specific call to action. And sometimes patient acquisition, if you will, or, you know, what I would say is either an inquiry or a request for appointment is probably the cleanest way to do that. I think this is an opportunity for us at Cincinnati Children's. I'm sure others have it much better figured out and more sophisticated than us at this point. But that is probably our cleanest way to measure ROI on campaigns, if I understand the question correctly.
Yeah, that's good. ROI is kind of a holy grail for the health system space. And, you know, the more you can actually measure true financial ROI, the better, but it's very difficult and you have to have lots of systems in place. And so it's the, you know, moving toward that is the goal. So that's great. That's it for questions. I think it's a good place to wrap, Brian.
Great. Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you, Chase. I appreciate the opportunity. I wish you guys all the best. Stay healthy, stay well.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you so much for joining us. We know you're a busy, busy dude. So we really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. Really my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Chase, you, sir, again, thank you for everything.
Absolutely. Enjoyed the conversation.
If you would like us to cover something that we're not talking about, let us know. Post it in the Zoom chat tool before you sign off. Or shoot us an email at nonormal@thinkrevivehealth.com. Next week, we'll be joined by Jarrett Lewis, who we've had on before. He's a partner at Public Opinion Strategies. And we're going to be discussing the latest where polling stands. I don't know why we'd be talking about polling right now. Nothing going on. Is there something going on? Huh. Interesting. Something. Okay. Maybe I'll have something to share. I don't know. Obviously, so much of what's happening in that space that it shall not be named impacts healthcare or would impact healthcare. So it'd be interesting to kind of hear from Jarrett about what they're hearing. So tune in for that. Remember, you can find a recording of this show at our website, thinkrevivehealth.com/COVID-19, COVID-19. Check us out on iTunes, wherever you listen to podcasts. And until next week, good luck out there in the no normal. Thanks for joining.